Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Plenty of well-known Christian authors, Matthew Fox, Richard Rohr, and others have talked about cosmic Christ, which is this idea that what was in Jesus, or the Christ element in Jesus, is a microcosm for what is in all people and in all things. And then we're starting to get into the language that pagans would use.
The Medicine Path podcast is an ongoing exploration into the intersections of spirituality, depth psychology, and psychedelics. The Medicine Path is a wholly independent and listener-supported project, so please consider becoming a supporter at patreon.com/medicinepath or by subscribing and leaving a review on iTunes. You can find out more information at medicinepathpodcast.com. Now, here's your host, Brian James.
Welcome to the Medicine Path Podcast. I'm your host, Brian James. On this episode, I speak with author and former ordained minister Mark Townsend, who left the Church of England to follow a calling to explore the earth-based path of Druidry. Mark is now an independent hedge priest who performs life ceremonies that weave together rituals and customs from the nature-based traditions of British Celtic culture. Bishop John Shelby Spong says of Mark, "Mark Townsend is a Christian who lives and thinks outside the box of traditional institutional Christianity. In a time in which traditional Christianity is in a steep decline, it is imperative that church leaders encourage its pioneer priests to help us all chart new paths on which to walk into whatever the Christian or even the post-Christian future will be. Mark Townsend is just such a priest." If you've been following the thread of my latest podcasts, you'll know that I've been wrestling with Christianity for a little while now. After much reading and contemplation and many conversations with different religious scholars and practitioners, I found myself coming back to feeling like I'm some kind of Christian pagan. Over the years, I've found that psychological and spiritual growth doesn't happen in a linear fashion. It tends to unfold in something more like a spiral, where we might find ourselves returning to a similar place in our viewpoint, only this time with a more mature perspective and a deeper understanding. And this has been the case for me with my relationship with Christianity. So it was a blessing to find Mark's 2012 book, Jesus Through Pagan Eyes, waiting to meet me. In that book, I found kinship with other spiritual seekers who had wrestled with Christianity and come to a point where Jesus could occupy a place on their altar as an inspiring teacher and healer, alongside the other teachers, deities, and perhaps nature spirits that speak to their heart. I think a significant part of the process for recovering from Christian monotheism, in a way that doesn't throw out the divine baby with the dirty bathwater, is cultivating an ability to distinguish between the historical Jesus of Nazareth, the divinized Jesus Christ of the Church, and the cosmic Christ of the mystics, what Mark refers to as the three Christs. He writes in his book, Jesus the Christ needs reclaiming as a universal mythos, something far beyond Christianity alone, something that points us to what is outside of everything and yet also strangely inside everything. This, I think, is what some of us call the pagan Christ, and what I've been calling the Christ beyond Christianity. In this episode, Mark and I get into all of this stuff and a lot more, so I hope you'll stick around. Before we get to our conversation, I just want to remind you that you don't have to wait so long for new episodes. You can gain early access to each and every episode by becoming a subscriber on both Patreon and Acast Plus. You could find links in the description below. Patreon members will also gain access to hours of yoga practice resources, in-depth workshop recordings, and exclusive bonus and unreleased podcast episodes, including my recent conversation with Dr. Rick Strassman, author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule. Currently, there are over 200 exclusive posts available only to patrons. Memberships start at just $3 a month, and you can easily cancel at any time. You can go to patreon.com/medicinepath for more information. And if you feel like you could use some personal support on your own medicine path of healing, growth, and transformation, please check out my range of mentorship and counseling services at brianjames.ca. Okay, that's all for now. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy this conversation with Reverend Mark Townsend on the medicine path. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Lovely to speak, Brian, and thank you for the invitation.
My pleasure. So if you could just let us know where you're living these days.
Yeah, well, I'm on the Welsh border in England, about 10 to 12 miles from the border of Wales. It's a very rural part of the country, more sheep than people. It's a lovely place to be. It's very laid back. Parts of Britain, like everywhere, are very busy and hectic, but this is, my life's busy enough, so I like the laid backness of the country surroundings. Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah, that resonates with me. We live about 30 kilometers from Victoria, which is a capital city of our province, but it's a pretty small city. It's well, now you know how cities expand.
Yeah, yeah.
kind of start to envelop neighboring rural communities and stuff. So yeah. It's like less than 500,000 people by far.
Right. Right.
So it's nice, yeah, because so much of the work I do is contained at home, especially over the past few years, doing a lot of work with people online and writing and things like that. So sure. It's nice to be in that natural environment.
So not knowing Canada at all, I've never been. I've been to the US, but so whereabouts sort of are you mid, you know, whereabouts on the map are you?
Yeah, to the far left of the map. So we're on an island off the west coast of Canada.
Oh, wow.
We're just across the water from Seattle and Vancouver in the other direction.
Right.
So nicely situated.
Yeah, I think my grandmother, she grew up in Saskatchewan, which I think is on the far other side. So, but as I say, I've never been myself. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. On my father's side, my great grandparents emigrated from Ukraine. They were Mennonites.
Right.
So during the Russian Revolution, a lot of people had to leave. And Saskatchewan, Canada, was offering up farmland.
Right.
For free or very, very kind of low cost to get allow these people to get started. And so on my father's side, that's where my family kind of emigrated to. And so I wonder if our grandparents knew each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are small communities incredible. Out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
Cool.
Lovely.
Yeah. Well, okay. So just a little background for listeners and maybe for you too. On the podcast and in my life, I've been in this journey of discovery, of questioning, of wrestling with Christianity and my Christian background. So on one side, like I was saying, my father's side, they were Mennonite.
Mm-hmm.
My father kind of disowned the religion. He was a child of the 60s and was more interested in rock music and drag racing cars.
Yeah.
So very kind of secular life. And then on my mother's side, they were Church of England Anglican. So I was actually baptized Anglican, but we didn't lead a spiritual life. I would go to Sunday school because I think I was interested in the stories, and I think my parents were interested in getting me out of the house every Sunday for a while. But that kind of spiritual impulse was always with me. And and recently I've just been going through this period of questioning where Christianity might fit into my life. And I had some kind of wild and unexpected encounters with this figure of Jesus and what I think of as like a Christ consciousness, and just trying to kind of sort that out in my own life. And so I've been talking to Jungians, theologians. For me, I want to bridge kind of the psychological understanding with the mystical understanding. That's been a big part of my journey. And so kind of recently I discovered your book, Jesus Through Pagan Eyes, and it was really great to find that book at this particular time where I'd kind of come to a place of just relaxing into this relationship with Jesus that I have, which is very much seeing him as a great teacher and healer, and having him as part of my kind of personal pantheon, but not exclusively Jesus, because so many other deities or spiritual figures have really connected to me. And so I want to honor them all, and trying to sort that out has been a bit difficult. But in your book, I found all these other people who had also gone through this kind of thing and come to a place of maybe resolution with it and kind of a relaxing into it. So yeah, it was just perfectly timed for me. So thanks for putting that book out there. You never know who it's going to reach, when it's going to reach them, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That was, and that's, I think it's 10 years old now. So I was looking it up actually, because we've got a similar sort of background, I'm sure, because I was christened, baptized Anglican as a baby. Then I kind of grew up in a nominally sort of Christian environment, went to Christian school, Church of England school, that sort of stuff. I then had a big sort of, I don't know whether it was a spiritual awakening or not, but I had a big sort of thrust into the Pentecostal movement, which is quite a scary sort of version of Christianity, I think. It sort of brought this idea of the aliveness of spirit very much into my mind, but of course it's very fundamentalistic, so I didn't last very long with that. And then one thing led to another, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in the future, but you know, I kind of found myself drifting into paganism and Druidry in particular. And then I was given an invitation. I'd written a few other sort of spiritual books, and someone from an American publisher, Llewellyn, they got in touch with me and said, do you want to do something about your pagan experience, but bringing in some sort of, you know, your Christian background? And one of the questions that I've always asked myself is where is Jesus in my life, and how do I relate to him as a concept and as a person? And I thought that was a great question to ask now that I was sort of right on the very edges of the church. And of course, I'd left the Anglican ministry because I was a priest for 13 years. I'd left the ministry by then, so it gave me I was in a very free position to ask some of the questions I wouldn't normally be even allowed to ask. And and you're right. Through that book, I was able to interview some fascinating people, none of whom saw themselves as Christo pagans. You know, I guess I'm more happy with that term, but these were full blown pagan people from various pagan paths, some very well-known people who gave me the privilege of being able to interview them about this Jesus figure. Because you take someone like Janet Farrar, who you know, very big name over here and in America, but over here in the UK, in Wicca, And she talks about the astral Christ. I'd read about this in her books. So I thought, you know, try and interview her. And she gave me a wonderful interview expressing, you know, what Jesus means to her as a non-Christian pagan. So it was me trying to sort of see whether you could hang on to this Jesus stroke Christ figure as a person who's now in paganism. Because I don't know about you, Brian, but I've noticed that in some forms of paganism, it's all right to have a relationship with anything and anyone, be it Ganesh or Kabbalah or deities of any religion apart from Jesus.
When it comes to Jesus. Everybody but Jesus.
Yeah. And I find that like sad because there's so many ways. I get that. I totally get that. Mm-hmm. Jesus Christ, the Orthodox Jesus Christ, is totally exclusive. And therefore, who could possibly know him apart from an Orthodox Bible believing Christian? But that's only a small part of the story. You know, Jesus the human, or Christ the consciousness, as you were talking about, that's there for everybody. And just like you can get to know other historical figures and other metaphorical deities or whatever. So I just thought that was a really exciting project. And I'm still on that journey. You know, people ask me questions now, what about this? What about that? And I still haven't got the answer because I think it's a sort of two steps forward. You know, one step back all the way of learning and then dropping the goal and then picking up again. And, you know, so I'm, still very much where that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can relate. I mean, it's something that comes up for me every few years, it seems like. And, you know, I was thinking about this recent round, which has lasted over a year now, as like my the fourth round of a wrestling match with this figure of Jesus, you know. Coming to a place where like I'm okay with this particular relationship. Like the way before I read your book, I was thinking of myself as a kind of pagan Christian. I'm trying to find a way like to incorporate both to allow for, you know, the kind of the polytheism that's come to me through these strange experiences I've had working with different plant medicines and through my yoga practice and kind of just being naturally open as a mystic type my whole life. So always having very vivid, strange and wild dreams and things like that. But then there's this figure of Christ who had come to me in some of my visions. And I'm like, God, I don't want to deal with you, man. Like there's so much kind of stigma due to the past 2000 years of Catholicism and Orthodoxy. So really for me, it's been about trying to get down to the kind of, how I've been thinking about it is like the pre-Christian Christ.
Yeah.
Like who is that figure outside of the church and all of the dogmas and everything else? And there's something very alive there still, which is kind of mysterious and strange to me.
Yeah, I found it very helpful to separate the figures of Christ and Jesus. It's something that Orthodox Christians cannot do because the creeds were all about bridging the gap and particularly the creeds of the third and fourth century, they were about sort of cementing Jesus and Christ, fully God, fully man. And therefore, you know, you cannot prize them apart to see what each one means. But I think when you do that, when you look again, I was given the freedom to do that. So when you look, first of all, at the figure of Jesus pre-Christianity, and I think you can get glimpses of him, again, it was quite a surprise to some of the pagan readers of my book and Christian readers of the book to learn about the quest for the historical Jesus, which has been going on for hundreds of years. But it's a movement largely within sort of thinking Christianity to try to unpick the Christian layers or the church's layers on the Jesus image to get back to who the original person might have been. And it's all very vague. It's all might have been rather than was, because, you know, we can't really know anything. But the current scholarship I find really exciting, because whereas a couple of hundred years ago, the sort of person they ended up with after this digging away was not a very, it's quite a sort of bland sort of figure. The person that they're now talking about is almost like a shaman. You know, it's a Jewish man steeped in his own culture and religion, but somehow on the edge of that and trying to awaken them to something that is deeply within them and present in the places where they've maybe not expected to find God or the divine. Hence, he's such a radical figure. And he's sort of, while on the one hand being fully within his culture, he's also countercultural, and ends up obviously paying the price by execution. This is a real figure. Now, this is all what they call the pre-Easter Jesus, or the pre-Easter Christ. And you can see glimpses of it, particularly in Mark's gospel and the earlier writings. It's not so prevalent in John, because John is a very late gospel and it's very much more Christ-centered. And then, so if you put that on one side and then look at the Jesus Christ, which is sort of, I think, that what I see is the second person of the Jesus Trinity, which is the, when you start applying Christ language to Jesus, I think you have to realize that that's come later, because Jesus wouldn't have used that terminology for himself. So that's the church in the future, looking back at the story of Jesus and trying to make sense of it and applying the term Christ and making Jesus Christ, to me is perfectly fine as long as it's seen in a sort of symbolic way. What happens with that Jesus Christ figure is it becomes totally literalized, and then the things that person says are made very literal and very exclusive. So when Jesus Christ says in John's gospel, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but by me," suddenly that's seen as therefore only Christians are saved. And that's where it gets very difficult with interfaith dialogue or with dialogue with pagans or whatever. So I can't possibly go there. That isn't the Jesus of history would never have said such a thing. So I want to know how we hold on to those kind of statements. And I think you can, when you take that even further and you start looking at Christ as a metaphor. Plenty of Christian, well-known Christian authors, Matthew Fox, Richard Rohr, and others have talked about cosmic Christ, which is this idea that what was in Jesus, or the Christ element in Jesus, is a microcosm for what is in all people and in all things. And then we're starting to get into the language that pagans would use. You know, seeing I think the Druids say Nuifre, you know, the spirit in all things. And we all know that polytheistic religions pantheistic religions are very good at seeing deity, the divine, sparkling away in all things. And I think this is a glimpse of it in Christianity. And I mean, there's just so much there when you start looking, and then you start throwing in the newly discovered, what they perhaps wrongly call Gnostic Gospels, Gospel of Thomas, which probably is as early as the four canonical Gospels. And the Jesus in that set of sayings is incredibly, I mean, it's more like a Zen teacher than a Messiah. He's dishing out koans to confuse people and to get them out of their ego. And this is, of course, pre-psychological, place, but using, you know, almost getting them out of their ego and into their self by confusing their conscious mind. Some of the sayings in Thomas's gospel are remarkable, and the sort of thing that could keep you up all night wondering over.
Can you lay one of those on us, one of those Jesus koans?
Yeah, there's one that he says in, and I say he says, because I think it's pretty widely acknowledged now that they just like the early sayings in Mark's gospel, Thomas, they probably do go back to him or something like. So there's one that says, if man consumes a lion, then he is blessed. But if lion consumes man, he is cursed. And it's sort of, what on earth does that mean? You know, coming from Jesus. And I might have quoted that wrongly, but it basically is saying that if you acknowledge and work with your animal nature, hence man absorbing lion, and integrate it. This is very Jungian. If you integrate mm-hmm. that nature, then integrate your shadow, then you will become blessed, because your shadow will become, I suppose, again in Jungian language, fully integrated and part of your true self. Whereas if you allow your inner lion to eat, to devour your man, so the animal to devour the human, that's really saying your base desires, if you let the shadow become uncontrollable, it's going to in the end cause trouble for you. I think you could even add a third and say, if you try to deny that shadow, it will become a big problem. And that's again a massive problem in Christianity, denying the dark, denying the scary, denying the... I had one of my previous bishops, who was my last bishop in the Church of England, he used to say, God cannot look upon darkness. God is only light. And I just wonder where the hell that comes from, because it's so unhealthy. I mean, the whole point of Jesus Christ, the story, and it is him embracing totally, fully the human mess and muddle, to the point of going through a human death, and to the point of saying on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's like almost the God image becoming so immersed within the darkness that he loses himself for a while. Now, if you're then going to say God can't look upon darkness, I mean, you can't, you know what I'm saying? And this sort of purity stroke, we must be righteous, we must be pure, we must be, it causes so much damage. And again, we see that all the time in strict monotheistic religions. You know,
all that animal nature gets repressed into the shadow, which then kind of gathers strength and then erupts very destructive and confused ways. I love that that little koan of how's it go again? If the man is consumed by the lion,
if the man devours the lion, then you will be blessed. If the lion devours the man, you'll be cursed. Look it up, because I've probably misquoted it, but it's along those lines.
I love it,
and it's a beautiful. I mean, there's so much. There's the fabulous. They used it in the film Stigmata, which was a sort of modern horror film, really, but Christian horror film. That was loosely based on the Gospel of Thomas. And there's another one where it says, pick up a stone and split a piece of wood and you'll find me, lift up a stone and I'll be there, or something again along those lines. And that's, again, it's completely in the face of this doctrine that says God is only there. God is inside that safe place, that behind that veil in the temple. Or, I mean, funny enough, that's one of the very images that the Bible uses to try to destroy that image of locking God away inside holy places, you know, the tearing of the temple. But in the Gospel of Thomas, it says, split a piece of wood and I am there, lift up a stone and you will find me. In other words, spirit is everywhere and deity is everywhere, and you know, Christ being the representative of all of us is in all things. And
The thing that always struck me about that one is that what he's talking about, splitting of the log under the stone, these are dark hidden places in nature. He's not saying look into the sun, you know, look into the light and I'll be there. No, he's saying I'm in the dark hidden places, which is just, I mean, so pagan.
yeah, it's incredible. no wonder a lot of Christians get nervous with the Gospel of Thomas, and No, because it does sound very pagan.
Yeah. And very universal. Like some of those things in John or in Gospel of Thomas. Well, first of all, I just want to kind of highlight what you went over quite quickly, but separating out the Trinity of Jesus, I think, as you referred to it. So on one hand, we've got the historical Jesus, the man. And then we've got the cosmic Christ, or the Christ consciousness, universal Christ. And then the third part of that is the Jesus Christ of the church, where Jesus has been fused with the Christ, and it's only through him, that kind of idea. And I think that's really helpful. And then once you do that, you can start to see, you know, who's speaking at any given moment. Is it Jesus, the rabbinical man? Is it the Christ, like in John? A lot of that, I think, is the Christ speaking in this universal way that shouldn't be taken so literally and ascribed to Jesus, the man. And then in the church, you can see the fusion, or it gets all muddled, the metaphoric with the literal, and all of that. But like you said, he was like a crazy wisdom teacher. Like he said, look, I only teach in parables. None of this is going to be super clear. Like, these are kind of riddles that you have to wrestle with yourself. And in that wrestling, I think you come to a more authentic spirituality.
That's a rewire you, really. That's a totally screw your brain up. And
stop the rational mind. I think of like putting a spoke or a stick in the spokes of the bicycle, and it's just like turns everything upside down.
There's a wonderful teacher I've been reading a lot of lately called Cynthia Bourgeau. I don't know if you've come across it. She believes, and I think again, it's one of these things that is by and large accepted as reality now, that Jesus didn't just come out of the blue. He came from a tradition. He came from a wisdom tradition of the Near East, and probably the East, that has found its way over. Some people believe that he possibly had connections with the Essene community, though they were much more pure, much more of a sort of purity, aesthetic sort of community than Jesus was, clearly. But there's this parable giving tradition, you know, within ancient Judaism that was there, in a similar way that the Zen koans are, you know, the teachers are using those little, almost like little spiritual traps to trap you and shock you out of that conscious mind or the rational mind. Which is why we don't get them, which I read them and I don't get them. And then suddenly you see with a new set of eyes and you do get them. You know, they seem so unfair and so, in a way, unjust, some of the stories that he told, until you look at them through. Well, I've got a little chapel in my garden now, because I don't go to a established church anymore, but I like to have a little sort of holy place. And more recently, I've been sort of reconnecting to my kind of mystical Christianity. So I built a little chapel, which is quite sort of orthodox in its way, as in Eastern Orthodox. And I made a stained glass window, and I painted the story of the prodigal son on it, because to me that is one of those incredible parables, which it does shock people because it doesn't sort of work out the way it's supposed to. In you know, he's a guy who's you know, he's basically acted as if his dad's dead. Give me my money ahead of my inheritance ahead of time, and then blows it all on wild living. Comes back, his son's pretty pissed off with him. Sorry, his brother is pretty pissed off with it.
Yeah,
even
like
with his dad.
The good brother who stuck around and was the beautiful son and all of that. Yeah. It's like, come on, like, how are you greeting this guy who's just been off like running wild?
And if we're honest, we all relate to that older brother, you know. And yet I rewrote that in a previous book, actually, because I used to run a a retreat called The Gospel of Falling Down, and it was very much along those lines. And I rewrote it for three people to read, as the father, the son, and the other son, and then to look at each of them as a voice within all of us. So we all have that father figure in us. We all have that rebellious son, and we all have the dutiful son figure within us. And, you know, the guy who comes out the worst in it is really the one who's the best behaved, you know, and it sort of throws it all on its head. But then when you look at it through these other eyes of the generosity of the divine and the beauty of the humble person who is who he or she is, the authentic self, and the person who's brave enough to, I don't think there's a classic repentance in that story. He just comes back because he's selfish. You know, he doesn't have a change of mind. But he breaks when his father hugs him, and then he melts. And that's the kind of the healing. The person who is met head on with love, pure unconditional love, and then melts into his arms. I mean, I think it's a beautiful picture, and it's something that you know, we all play, certainly the two son roles in our lives. And maybe there's a bit of the father too, you know, this unconditional. I mean, it's also a story that, of course, well, all of Jesus' stories are pre-cross. You know, nobody saw the cross coming. You know, us fundamentalists would say it's all a big plan, but I don't believe Jesus would have known what was going to happen. So he's telling these stories ahead of the cross. So some say, well, where's the cross in that story? Well, the cross is in the father looking out longingly, hoping that his son comes back. That's the pain. The cross represents human pain, and not as an ugly sacrificial symbol of an angry, you know, blood sacrifice to an angry deity, but as an outpouring of beautiful human love, which is painful, you know, which hurts. So that's the cross in that story. I'm waffling on, aren't I? I tend to do that.
I love listening to it. You know, that is a really striking story. And I love how you wrote it out so that people could find themselves in the myth. I mean, that's something that mythopoetic teachers will often do is, you know, pay attention to what part of the story or what character in the story really jumps out at you.
Yeah.
And kind of hone in on that and try to get into that part of it. Because there's something in you that's resonating with that aspect of the story. And yeah, there's something about that, the embracing, forgiving father being, I think, you know, the way I would look at it is that's the Christ in us. That's the capacity we have for that depth of love.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that kind of got me started on this latest round of wrestling with Christianity is because I found myself in the jungles of Peru drinking ayahuasca. And after this kind of death experience, being consumed by this anaconda, being completely torn apart, then coming out of that and having this experience of Christ consciousness. And what was kind of resonating through me was, this is what it's like to love like Christ. And what I found is it was such an expanded state of consciousness that it was completely inclusive, completely accepting of everything, people with all of their idiosyncrasies and their faults and, you know, misdeeds and everything, and, you know, the catastrophes of the world. It was consciousness big enough that it just allowed everything to be as it is.
Yeah.
And what I felt at the core of that was just absolute peace.
Yeah.
It's like, it's all good. It really is all good. And I mean, you know, I think it's, I wrote about it in a little book that I put out, and I called it The Final Lesson, because to me, it sets such a high watermark for the rest of my life. It's not something that I don't think I'll ever be able to fully integrate, but it gives me a kind of marker of what's possible, because it was so experiential. Like, I felt it. There was just no denying it.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I had to wonder, like, well, what the hell was that experience? Was that something that my, my individual psyche concocted for me and based on my Christian background, just associated it with Jesus Christ? And or was it the actual energy or power of Christ, you know? So, I mean, incredible. I'm kind of agnostic about it. I don't know, but the experience was real. And so I had to really wrestle with it, and I continue to.
Yeah.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
But in a way, that sounds like a life, death, resurrection experience, doesn't it? You know, the way you just described it. So in a sense, it would tap into that archetype. I had an experience when I first joined a particular Druid group. I said I'm on the Welsh border. We about 50 miles from here. There's a waterfall, beautiful place in nature, and a cave with very jagged rocks inside. And I was given an initiation rite for this particular group, and I was taken into this cave, and I had to kneel on my knees for quite a long time. It was quite painful, and it was described to me as a death, as a burial, and but also as a womb, and coming out. And even though it was a beautifully rich pagan, earthy ritual, I had to also relate it to my life, death, resurrection stories of Jesus. You know, because it was just them, and that's why that is a universal archetype, and it doesn't belong to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And I think there's so many overlaps, and it's just integrating it is the hard thing, isn't it? Really working out how it all fits together. But to me, whenever I sort of get myself too convinced of something that feels verging on the exclusive, I feel like I put a straitjacket on and I have to get rid of it.
Some of us are just built that way, you know, like you said. Well, Jung really helped me kind of I don't want to say resolve, it's the wrong word, but kind of come to a place of acceptance about kind of multifaceted, polytheistic nature of things, by seeing the underlying archetypal pattern, like you said. Because if you're seeing that that's what's manifesting in all these different stories and personal experiences, it makes sense in a way. Then it also allows for the different expressions of that particular archetypal pattern. And it's like, well, it's all okay, because at the core, it's like a universal truth or reality that's just expressing in different colorful ways. And so Jung for me was like a bridge in a way. To the way I think of it is like a bridge between my modern rational mind and the mythic mind, which is loves the stories and loves many stories and is okay with polytheism or pantheism, however we think about it. Yeah, kind of like a place to hold the tension of those opposites, you know, the mind that wants to concretize and to exclude and define and all of that with like what, you know, the soul, which is just like, hey, look, it's all beautiful. It's all part of this great tapestry. Don't get so hung up on the details and definitions, you know. Well, like, one part of your story I wanted to ask you about, I don't know if it's clear to people, but you were actually an ordained minister in the Church of England, right? Like back in the 90s. And then somewhere along the way, you had like, I think what you call is like a fall. And then this contact with paganism, which ignited something in you. So like, I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
So, as I said at the very beginning, I came into Christianity through Pentecostalism, and even though it's probably what I needed to sort of strike a match for me, my mind is naturally liberal thinking. You know, I'm always asking questions, and the Pentecostal tradition, for all its good, is very narrow in terms of its. You know, it has a very fundamentalist take on scriptures, and you just don't ask questions. So I found myself being squeezed out of that tradition. Cut a very long story short, I ended up in the Church of England. I'd been brought up in a Church of England school, and the Church of England has three distinct traditions within it. It has a liberal tradition, but also has a very Catholic tradition and a very evangelical tradition. So it was natural for me as a Pentecostal to first of all go into the evangelical part of the Church of England, and while I was a Pentecostal, I had this strong feeling of ministry, you know, that I was called to be a pastor. That came with me into the Church of England, and very quickly I became an ordinand, so I started training for the ministry. But during that time, I also started, as they call it, climbing the candle, which means going from the evangelical to the Catholic end. And through the liberal, I'm a natural liberal, but I loved the ritual. I discovered the ritual of the high church within Israel. I went to Israel for about 4 months to try and clear my head. And I came back totally mind blown, not because of the natural sort of holy places, which were very special, but because of the very ornate and beautifully ritualistic Catholic and Orthodox churches. So anyway, I ended up being ordained in the Church of England as a sort of middle way, quite slightly high church priest. I'm now in Leinster, in Herefordshire, on the Welsh border. I was ordained about 15 miles north of here in a little church in Ludlow. Then I came to Leinster as my second post. And the story that you referred to as a fall, it's not anything I'm proud of, but I was married and with two beautiful children, and my marriage was pretty rocky. And I was, while I was here in this town as the vicar, I went through a massive sort of breakdown, but both in terms of my marriage fell apart, but also me myself. You know, it was pretty difficult because you're so on show to the world going through this stuff. And I made the biggest mistake I've ever made in my life, which was during this time I had a relationship with someone else. Now, that's all I'm going to say about that. It was very silly mistake. But 2 years later, or 2 years after it had all been sort of dealt with, I was about then to go to another church south of the diocese. I'd been through interviews and was ready to be made vicar of this church. And I just knew in myself, because I'd have to go through a ritual where the bishop would lay his hand on my head and pray for the spirit to blah, blah, blah. I knew that I had to tell him my story. So I went and made a confession. And the result of that was that he said, you need to resign, which was, that's fine. I mean, that was the sort of risk I was I knew I needed to take that risk. So he said,
hold on, there's no absolution. I mean, I thought that was the point of, like, they can't use confession against you.
I all I'm saying is what happened. I took advice from various friends of mine, clergy, all of you said, you're stupid, mate. But I said, no, I've got to do this. No, I knew I had to, and it was the right thing to do. But yeah, and I mean, my bishop probably would say, well, it was informal confession, so the seal of the confession wasn't necessary. Mm. Whatever. The point is, and I don't in any way blame the person. It was me needing to clear my conscience and do what the book said.
I wonder if like unconsciously some part of you knew that this would screw up the trajectory you were on,
it may be. One of my friends, a wonderful druid leader called Philip Cargom, he said to me, sometimes, and he used the analogy of a mother and a about to give birth, and he said, I don't know if this is true, but I've been told that when the baby kind of psychologically knows it's time to escape this very warm and safe environment of the womb, a certain substance is secreted into the waters that will make it a toxic place for that baby to stay. So in order to be born, it needs to, and I mean, I don't know whether that's true. It might be a myth, but it's a beautiful analogy for what
it
I think happened to me.
Uninhabitable in order exactly. to force yeah. the expulsion from paradise.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So maybe there's something in that. Maybe underneath I knew that that's what I had to do in order to escape the rigidity of the church. And I still love the Church of England. I've got friends and family within it. I couldn't be a minister within it myself now because I feel it would be too small for my crazy head. But I was given the gift of being told to resign. so I did, and I was given a time, 3 years, and then you can come back. After those 3 years, I'd learned so much, and well, I'd been into I swam in the pagan waters, I'd done gay weddings, I'd done so many things I couldn't do as an Anglican priest that I thought I can't possibly come back. So I momentarily had my orders. They call it your little dog.
Yeah, she just woke up.
they call it PTO, permission to officiate. So I had that back, and then the day after I had that letter, I sent it back saying, thank you very much, but I can't. And at that point I left for good. I severed my orders and I joined another, an independent, much more free thinking church, which is what I'm still in. And I'm still able to be part of everything else that I have. So yeah, I mean, that's that story.
Well, if I could just ask you about your encounter with druidry and paganism. Yeah. Like, was it somebody you met at the pub, or, how'd that come about?
No, when I look back, I've always been fascinated by things in terms of magic and earth-based religion. And I mean, magic, I'm a member of the magic circle and have been for a couple of decades, as in conjuring, and that is a symbolic way of performing magic, so it's even that, even though that sounds kind of a little bit odd, conjuring magic or sleight of hand magic is a mimic of real magic. And so even that shows me that way, way back, I was fascinated by things that shouldn't happen, things, the unexplained and psychic things. And through my training and through my sort of experience in the Church of England, I was always one to bring in like Tibetan Buddhists to come and do their stuff in my church, and New Age things, crystals. I was always bringing things into the church that other people would perhaps frown at. But I thought, we needed to be open to, if we're honest about following Christ, who was open, we need to be. So in a sense, there's no surprise that when I found myself on the outside of the Church of England, the the place that I knew I had to really explore was paganism. And I wrote, I just mentioned Philip Cargom. I wrote to him because I knew of him. I knew that I knew he was the chief of the Order of Bards, Obeits and Druids, which is a big Druid organization that was the first one I kind of learned about. And lovely man, he invited me to go and speak at their winter gathering at Glastonbury in Somerset in England. And there was about 300 Druid pagans there. I say pagans, Druids there, because some wouldn't say they're pagan. And I was invited to go and perform as a vicar who did magic, which was very
the
strange.
Novelty of that.
So you got and have you heard of Professor Ronald Hutton, historian? No. So it was hilarious because I was asked to do this mind reading session, and I had Ronald Hutton reading his mind, Philip Cargom, a couple of others. I also noticed someone in the audience who I knew, I'd known back in my Pentecostal days, and I thought, that's interesting. So I at one stage, I asked, hands up, how many of you used to see yourself as Christian? Of course, nearly all of their hands went up. And when I said Catholic, most of them. So it's very interesting that a lot of people who, because Catholicism is a very magical form of Christianity at its best, you know, mm-hmm. It's very symbolic, and a lot of people who obviously had a deep spirituality but couldn't express it within traditional Christianity have found their way into Druidry and I imagine other forms of paganism. And that night changed my life, because I went there as an ex-vicar and was introduced as a vicar. And I spent the whole night there, and not one of them, so many people came up to talk to me, but not one of them tried to influence me in any way. Now, you try and reverse that, you know,
right.
300 Christians and a pagan comes and spends the night with them. How many times are they going to try and convert them? You know, so I thought, well, this is just wonderful. These people walk their talk, you know, they're genuine, very welcoming, very hospitable, but also incredibly exciting, the sort of stuff that we were talking about. And that's a long time ago. That's about 15 years. But that's how my sort of introduction into Druidry happened. And I don't know what I call myself now. I have no idea. Am I Christian? Am I Druid? I'm happy to use any of these titles as long as they're not exclusivized. I'm very wary of the term Christian. I know what I mean by it, but I also know what others do, and that's what scares me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I can relate. Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky. Like, even when I was calling myself, like, a pagan Christian, it's like, that Christian really stands out in high relief, and it has a lot of associations for people from our cultures, right? So it's like, yeah, I always want to add like the asterisk and go, well, not that kind of Christian, you know, but like I have this relationship with this entity, this power, this person, but it's complicated.
It's very complicated. And if you start to really sort of de-churchify it and say I'm a friend of Jesus, that sounds even worse, because you think, my God, that sounds so sort of born again.
I just, you know, I guess like he's on my altar, but really for me, like the symbol of the Sacred Heart is more powerful than any depictions of that person Jesus, because I mean I think that's the real mystery. Well, at the heart of the Christ. And I love those paintings of him where he's kind of opening his robes and he's like subtly pointing at this burning heart in his chest, you know, and some of them are quite gruesome where he's like ripping open his chest to show you. And I always felt like what he's saying in that is like, look, here's what it's all about, you know, forget all of that other stuff. It's right here and it's within you. And I've got like the picture of the Sacred Heart on my altar, along with, you know, Asclepius and a Ganesha and some totem animals from the land here. And there's something about the pagan mindset that is inclusive.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is so important for us. Well, maybe us kind of, I don't know, what do we call the misfits, you know, the spiritual misfits, where it's just so hard for us to fit into any boxes. Like, it gives us a kind of a home in a way, and maybe a place to find some others. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Misfits is a good description. I mean, I often look at the sort of people that, again, going back to Jesus, the sort of people that most related to him, and they seem to be misfits. You know, they certainly weren't comfortable on the inside of any institution, and they were pretty much spat upon and victimized. And you know, he seemed to have time for them, and he himself, you know, if there's ever a misfit Messiah, I mean, you know, or I'm still fascinated by the person of Jesus. And another thing that I find happening to me is, no matter what I get into, and recently it's been the cosmos. I've got a bloody big telescope behind me, because I just bought this, and I love looking at, because it's, you know, you look at Andromeda Galaxy, it's 39 billion miles away. I mean, it's just totally mind-blowing. I don't find it in any way sort of threatening to my faith. I find it expansive. But whenever I get more, I find myself being taken over by a subject, sooner or later, I start to feel almost a little lost, and I have to come home. And the coming home is actually to my little chapel with the icon of Jesus, icon of Mary. That's my coming home. And it's, it would be, I'm sure if I was Indian, it would be Ganesha and Krishna. You know, it's not that it's Jesus and Mary, but that's my home. You know, I was reading through some of my stuff just because I wanted to refresh myself with the things in the Jesus Through Pagan Eyes book, and you know, some of the things that, I mean, one of the things I recapped was the word metanoia, which is the word translated repent, and I discovered again today that it does not mean what these Bible bashing Christians think it means. Means to go beyond the mind. So it's almost psychology, you know, to go beyond the mind, to go beyond the rational mind, and to rewire yourself into this other mind, this expansive Christ consciousness stuff. I mean, it's just, there's so much there. And this is all pre-psychology, you know, it's...
Well, I think Jung would say that it was psychology. It's just they didn't have that word for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there was no kind of split at that point. So psychology, religion, mythology, they all served that kind of function.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right. Yeah, like the way those terms even have been mistranslated and dogmatized. You have to really get down. You have to get down to the roots of some of these words to uncover their true meaning. And that for me, that kind of etymological archaeology or alchemy, almost like getting down to the fundament of it, that's been really helpful in me. And kind of the way I think of it is decolonizing my mind and kind of opening myself up to the big mind and to that more expansive consciousness. And then just kind of relaxing into that. Like it feels like a relaxing into my natural proclivity toward polytheism or a nature-based spirituality and things like that. And then in that, Jesus becomes kind of like a brother or a companion in a way, you know?
Yeah. Which is clearly what the Thomas Jesus, from going back to the Gospel of Thomas, it's much more like an older brother figure, almost like a mirror, you know, a human mirror to show you what you are, rather than a kind of divine light to show you what you're not. You know,
well, doesn't Thomas mean the twin or something
like
that?
Exactly. Yeah.
So taken that way as, you know, then it's like Jesus is kind of like my divine twin or something. Mm. And just like he had these two sides, you know, on one hand, there's a story. This is my favorite story from all the Gospels, because I think it shows the human side. Like, it's like the man side of the God man, you know, where they're out walking around doing their ministry thing, and they come across, they're all really hungry. It's been a few days probably since they ate, and they come across a fig tree, and everyone gets excited. Oh, here comes like a little snack. And turns out that the fig tree is not fruiting. There's no figs on the tree. And like Christ, instead of performing a miracle and having all these figs like bloom out of the tree and feed everyone, he curses the fig tree. He's like, damn you for all time for not giving us your fruit. I'm like, what a petty kind of thing. Like, you know, and I thought, like, I talked to a client once, a counseling client, who was kind of lamenting over her reactivity in her relationship. And I said, look, even Jesus got hangry, you know? Yeah. I don't know if you know this term. It's maybe a North American thing, but hangry is like when you get angry because you're hungry.
Right.
You're hangry.
Right. Yeah.
So like even Jesus got hangry.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
take absolutely. It easy on yourself.
Yeah.
But like, why would they leave that story in the gospel? Cause, I mean, there's a lot of ways you could kind of interpret that to spin it, but it shows Jesus in an all too human light.
Yeah, and I mean, that what you just said, why would they leave that in? That's a hallmark for saying that it's an authentic story. It's one of the criterion that the Jesus scholar, that the historical Jesus scholars use, is if anything seems so out of character and almost embarrassing that it would be easy enough to remove, but it's still in there. It says it probably did happen, like statements like, you know, let the dead bury the dead, or the very embarrassing when he almost gets put right by Syrophoenician woman who is talking about, he's having a meal with his disciples, and a woman from another culture comes up and asks for some food, and he says no. She says, well, can I eat the scraps? Even the dogs eat the scraps from under the table.
And
you know, it's like he's calling her a dog. I mean, it's terrible.
She's like a Gentile dog.
Yeah. But then he seems to kind of see how wrong he was, and it's an example of the Son of God, who we all, the Orthodox would say is totally sinless, actually made a balls up and then corrected himself and, you know, almost apologized. I mean, I find it astonishing and beautiful, because, you know, this makes Jesus relatable to, this makes him human, and you know, the weeping tears like blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. There's so many of these very human pictures that very often left out, you know, by the people who want him to be the great savior, Messiah, who's totally sinless and perfect.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that story that you just told, I mean, I think that's a great example of like metanoia, of that change of heart that can come about, like in most unexpected, usually unexpected ways, like not something that you're trying to make happen. But it just, something strikes you in the moment, and you call that grace or whatever. Mm. But
Yeah.
Wonderful. So help me out here. Druids.
Mm.
Is this like a kind of regressive fantasy of like what our ancient ancestors used to do? Or, I mean, what's the, What's it based on? It's always never been clear to me. It sounds wonderful, and it sounds like my kind of people, hanging out in nature, drinking mead and ale, and honoring the natural elements and the passing of the seasons and all of that. Like, all right, sign me up. But is it based on an actual tradition that we know about, or is it kind of an imaginative reconstruction, something like that?
Yeah, I think Druids are a very honest group of people, and they would say it's a bit of both. From my experience, and I've kind of been loosely part of the scene for about 15 years, the very modern pagan Druid movements probably began around the same time as Wicca was formed, you know, with Gerald Gardner. Ross Nichols is the name who we associate with that current revival of Druidry, and they were great friends, and one went into one direction and one went the other. So modern Druidry is quite distinctively pagan. It's very open to other religions, and there are plenty of Christian Druids, but generally speaking they follow the Celtic pagan stories. I was going to say a word then that I might get wrong, Mabinogion. So there's a set of books that the Welsh, almost like Greek mythology, but a Welsh version, you know, gods and goddesses, and what wonderful set of stories, Taliesin the Bard. And so they plug into that kind of philosophy and spirituality. There is pre the current modern day Druidry, there's what they call revival Druidry, which is a couple of hundred years old and more Christian based, because it was largely Christian groups who were trying to plug back into something quite romantic and what they considered to be ancient. And then of course the ancient Druids themselves, we know almost nothing about. We have a little bit from Caesar and a few other Roman writers, but it's quite negative. They probably were a high caste priestly group within Celtic cultures, probably seen as the wise men, maybe political, but certainly spiritual leaders. There was also bards who were part of that movement, and ovates, which are probably similar to what we currently mean as witches, you know, wise people, seers. They're a wonderful group of people who walk the talk and are very honest about the fact that some of it has probably been stolen from other cultures or made up.
Because a lot of these old traditions were oral. Nothing was ever written down, right? So no. If it gets persecuted or suppressed along the way, we sever the connection to that tradition and that lineage. So I mean, we see this in more recent times with what happened here in North America with the First Nations people. What ends up happening when trying to recreate, when there's a kind of renewal of the tradition, is you have to look to unbroken traditions to get like an inkling of what your own ancestors were probably doing. And so there tends to be this intermingling of traditions in a way, you know, the kind of the severed tradition having to pick up something from a living tradition. And we see this like everywhere, but it sounds like that's what's happened maybe with Druidry. I like the fact that they're just honest about it and upfront about it.
It's
a good sign.
Absolutely.
And also what strikes me when you talk about it is someone like Saint Francis of Assisi. I mean, look, my personal opinion is that every once in a while some charismatic mystical person would come up and start attracting attention, and instead of the church trying to ignore them and pretend they don't exist or whatever, they kind of like they enfold them in the church by making them a saint. But really, like, they can be very problematic figures. Like, when you look at St. Francis's prayers and the canticles to the sun and moon and things like that, I mean, come on. Guy was clearly a pagan. Talking dead birds.
Yeah, absolutely. Brother fire and sister wind. And yeah, I mean, it's
totally great.
It's fantastic. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, when I'm looking for, like, Christian prayers that kind of fit within my worldview, he's one of the few that I find where I can really feel good about that prayer, you know.
I wear a Franciscan cross. So San Damiano is the one that spoke to him in the little broken down church. But yeah, I've got a huge affinity to Francis. And I mentioned Father Richard Rohr earlier on. He's a wonderful Catholic spiritual teacher from the Franciscan tradition. Talks about cosmic Christ and does stuff on the Enneagram. Wonderfully switched on guy. I did a you did the, was it Peru that you did your vision quest type? I did one with Richard Rohr in New Mexico, in just I think it's just west of Santa Fe, a place called Ghost Ranch, and that had a very much a death resurrection experience as well, where we symbolically died with this very powerful ritual where we drew blood on ourselves. And I mean, it was amazing, considering it was a Roman Catholic retreat, and we were dancing around fires naked. It was incredible.
Well, yeah, Richard Rohr, he was, I think, quite influenced by the mythopoetic men's movement, and I think even started his own men's circles that drew on you know, what people like Robert Bly and Michael Mead had done in the 90s, but put it in more of a Christian context, but a obviously non-dogmatic Christian context, right? What's the word for that? Is it ecumenical, like a kind of Christianity that's open to other faiths? Is that the right
word? I mean, usually ecumenical means a Christianity that's open to other Christian faiths. So it's beyond that. It's got interfaith, I suppose, interreligious, interfaith.
It's like, we accept everyone, the Protestants, the Catholics.
But I love Richard Rohr. I mean, he more than any other person within Christian ministry, he's been like a mentor figure to me for 22 years. Partly because that period where I was very much a broken, sort of wounded person, his material on what he calls the spirituality of imperfection really spoke to me. You know, the metaphors that he used, and he just felt safe. You know, that's one of the things about what I kind of judge whether a teacher or a personality is kind of in that, you know, in the other mindset, by whether they frighten the hell out of you or not. Because, you know, if I was to tell my story to a person, I'm thinking now of two different people. I know that someone like Richard Rohr, he would just embrace you and hold that no matter what you said. And it's just an all-embracing openness, which I can imagine why people were attracted to Jesus, you know, and other spiritual teachers like that. But when you got
all those misfits feeling safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas if you're feeling a sense of judgment or disapproval, or any of those kind of egotistical, then it's gonna affect your ego as well, and the defenses are gonna come up, and so it's maybe that's what that word mirror, you know, or the twin Thomas, you know, maybe that's about, you know, finding people who can mirror back to you the beauty of your own soul.
Well, and I was just reminded of the way you kind of expanded or interpreted the prodigal son story, you know, and so it sounds like Richard Rohr really embodies that father energy.
Absolutely.
That embraces the wayward son, you know, probably because he's been a wayward son himself, you know. I think that's what it takes. It's like, takes one to know one.
Absolutely.
And to know one is to love one. Well, that's great. I was going to ask you if there have been any kind of guiding lights for you in your, on your way as you kind of fumble through pagan Christianity and myself, like, so Richard Rohr being one that's been helpful. I heard Cynthia Bourgeau in terms of connecting to that Christ within. I think she's real kind of from the mystical contemplative tradition. And I think from what I can tell of her, she's really embodying something authentic. It's not like she's just talking about mysticism and cosmic Christ, but I feel like she's someone who's really in tune with that.
Yeah. She's lived it every day of her life for, for decades. I mean, she's walking the talk, as they say. Others, Henri Nouwen, he's deceased now. He's a wonderful, very, again, a wounded healer, Roman Catholic priest. It's funny that, they tend to be Catholic priests for me, or Cynthia Bourgeau isn't, but then she's steeped in Benedictine spirituality. So in a sense, that's Catholic. It's funny.
Sorry, give me that name again. Henri.
Henri Nouwen. Yeah. It's Nouwen. Yeah. It's spelled Henry, but it's Henri Nouwen. He was a French, I think Jesuit. Another wonderful Jesuit priest is Gerard Hughes, who wrote a book called God of Surprises and another called God in All Things. They're beautiful books. Matthew Fox, another massive light within this.
For me, I like kind of what Matthew Fox is doing, but something about his writing, the way he kind of embodies the teachings, never really resonated with me for some reason, but I appreciate him and I kind of love what he's all about, it's kind of not enough earthiness or darkness to him, I think, for me,
I get that. In the pagan world, I've mentioned Philip Cargom. His books are wonderful for people interested.
That's great, because I was going to ask about, like, if people are interested in learning a little bit about Druidry or paganism. But specifically Druidry, Philip Cargom would be one of the go-tos.
Absolutely. And also Emma Restel Orr, she is a wonderful teacher, pagan priestess, Druid, Emma Restel Orr. She's just got away with words. She writes with such poetry. And real wisdom, beautiful books, There's a lovely introduction to paganism by Joyson River Higginbotham. I don't know whether they're a Canadian or American, but that's a very good.
But they're
book.
They're in your book, right?
Yeah.
Kind of coined the term Christo-pagan.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, I tried to track them down. They're pretty quiet in terms of, I don't think I could find a website. I found an old Facebook page, but.
Right. I'll see if I can look them up.
All these druids or pagans, they're, maybe not so much on the technology side of things, the self-promotion. They're just off in the woods, happily doing their thing, and who can blame them? that's great. And then of course, there's your book, Jesus Through Pagan Eyes, which is great because it collects a lot of stories and essays from other people. And so you get a real kind of wide swath of perspectives, which is really fun. Oh, it's fantastic. It's just really nice to meet you, kind of feel like a kinship with you.
Absolutely.
It feels good for me to find other people who are kind of walking with with a foot in
both worlds
two of the worlds. Who knows, right? So that's really nice, and I really appreciate you sharing your story with us and spending some time.
Thank you. No, it's been lovely, Brian, and stay in touch, please, because. And if I come across anything else that might be useful or whatever, names or websites, I'll send them to you.
Well, that'd be great. Yeah, I'll include a little resource list for people in the description of this episode, and we'll let you know when it's out.
Lovely. Good.
All right. Cheers.
Fabulous. Thank you. Yeah, lovely talking.
Take care.
Cheers, Brian. Bye. Cheers. Bye.
The Medicine Path is produced by Brian James on unceded Coast Salish territory, Vancouver Island, Canada. For more information, visit brianjames.ca. Music by Olive Artizzoni, a.k.a. Greenhouse. Join the Medicine Path tribe and gain early access to episodes and the full podcast archives at patreon.com/medicinepath. May the road rise up to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. May the rain fall soft upon your fields. Until the next time we meet on the Medicine Path.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.